Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Salute e salve, benvenuti su Storia d'Italia Extra. Questa puntata avrei voluto metterla sul podcast principale se solo il professor Thomas Noble parlasse un ottimo italiano. Questo non è il caso, non posso certo fargliene una colpa, ma era veramente troppo importante per me intervistarlo perché uno dei suoi libri, oggi ne sto leggendo anche un secondo, ma uno dei suoi libri si intitola La Repubblica di San Pietro. E io lo trovo citato ovunque quando si parla dell'evoluzione della Chiesa romana nel corso dell'VIII secolo, un secolo cruciale, assolutamente cruciale, in cui veramente nasce il papato come lo conosciamo. E per me era troppo importante quindi intervistarlo e avere il suo punto di vista sull'VIII secolo, in un certo senso come introduzione all'VIII secolo. Quindi spero che vi piacerà questa intervista in inglese al professore in generale sul rapporto tra papato, Franchi e Longobardi, ma anche su come il papato evolve nel corso del secolo. E all'inizio addirittura gli chiedo qual è il suo papa preferito dell'VIII secolo, vediamo se vi interesserà sapere la sua risposta. Vi lascio alla puntata. Salute e salve, that's how I start every podcast, professor, and it's such a pleasure and honor to have Thomas F.X. Noble, professor, great scholar in the history in general of the High Middle Ages, I will say, but in particular about the papacy and the relationship of the papacy with the Franks and the Byzantines. I've had the pleasure of reading, I'm showing it in a video, but this fantastic book, The Republic of St. Peter, which is a seminal book on this subject. So I thought, let me contact the professor and see if he's kind enough for a little interview. And you are kind enough. Thank you so much.
No, I'm delighted to be here. Thank you.
Fantastic. So, to warm up, I have a bit of a silly question to start. Now, we will go into the more serious one later. But the silly question is about which one is your favorite 8th century pope? Because there are so many and each one is kind of different from each other, I thought.
No, that's very true. I think in many ways that my favorite is Hadrian the First. For a number of reasons, as you say, there were a great many popes in the 8th century. They tended to have very short pontificates, and Hadrian's pope for 23 years, one of the longest pontificates in history.
Yeah,
and he was, I think, very very capable, very adroit. He becomes pope after a very difficult period of time in the city of Rome itself. There had been violence and political strife and struggles, and the Lombard king Desiderius is threatening. And eventually, of course, Charlemagne comes into Italy and defeats Desiderius, and that creates an opportunity, an opening for the Pope,
yeah,
for institutional development, for territorial development, and also the Pax Italia. Italy is in peace for the first time in decades, and money starts flowing into Rome, and Hadrian engages a massive building campaign all over the city. And he has to deal with the Byzantines on the question of images, iconoclasm. And of course also the Byzantines are attempting, well, the Lombards, the heirs of Desiderius, are trying to engage with the Byzantines to restore themselves in Italy. So Hadrian has to be concerned with that. He has to negotiate relations with the Franks because his father, Pippin, had made a series of promises to the popes. Perhaps we'll talk about those later in the 750s. Charlemagne comes into Rome, and at Easter time in 774, he essentially says, okay, I agree, we're going to do all of that. But Charlemagne, until that time, had never been in Italy. He actually had no idea what the scene looked like. And he then has sort of some of his agents exploring Italy, and Hadrian is writing him these very anxious letters. What are you going to do? What are you going to do? What are you going to do? And eventually in 781 and again in 787, Charlemagne kind of settles the territorial situation. And on the whole, Hadrian didn't get exactly what had been promised in the 750s. In a couple of ways, he got a little bit more than had been promised then, but he got overall a very good deal. So it was a good negotiation. So and then of course Hadrian also had to deal with a kind of a Western heresy, a Christological heresy, adoptionism, which emerged in Spain. So this required him, the image question on the one hand, and then the adoptionism on the other hand, required him to be capable as a theologian. He has to manage the territorial scene in Italy. Some of his predecessors, and we'll talk about this, had begun to claim that they ruled over an independent, autonomous state. But Hadrian is really the first pope who is in a position actually to govern this state. So he has to think about all of that. So as I say, I think in many ways he's a very versatile individual.
Yeah, between theology, construction, the relationship with the great powers, and actually enacting an administration, an actual political administration, he's probably one of the most consequential popes in history, I would say, not even the 8th century.
I think that's right. And it's, you know, you can always ask... it's always fun in history to ask what if, you know, to ask the hypothetical question. You know, if you look at the popes before Hadrian, 5 or 10 years would be a very long pontificate, and he has 23 years. What if he died in a couple of years? you know, what might have happened? So the fact that he was there for such a long time, and, you know, there are some other ones, I think in the 19th century, I'm sorry, Pio Nono, who was pope for such a long time, or Leo the 13th, who was pope for a very long time, or John Paul II, who was pope for a very long time. They were consequential, of course, but also in part because they were there for a very long time.
Yeah, so obviously.
So that, I think, it has to be taken into consideration that Hadrian just was there for a long time. And it's interesting, you know, that Einhard tells us that when Charlemagne had news that Hadrian died, he wept as if he'd lost a brother. I mean, there was a bond between the two men, I think.
Yeah, and that really set the scene for that so important relationship, right, between the Franks and the papacy. It would have been short, maybe... Yeah, there wouldn't be such a strong continuous bond, but we jumped a bit the gun, obviously, because I made you a question and forced you to choose between an 8th century pope. So we went a bit ahead. For your information, my podcast today is at around the year 712. So I haven't talked about most of this yet. Mm-hmm. I've talked though in great length about
the previous period. So, you know, in the historiography of the birth of the Papal States, at the beginning of your book, there is basically a description of the main historiographical positions. Let's say the Carolingian and the Byzantine. And here we're not talking about the empires per se, but we're talking about the relationship with the birth of the papacy. So can you explain to my listeners what are those, and what is also the position that you are so eloquently explaining in the book?
Well, if we look at the very beginning of the 8th century, if we look first at the Byzantine world, the Byzantine Empire is in full crisis.
Yeah.
There is political instability in Constantinople itself. They are being attacked on the eastern flank by Islam, Muslims. They are being attacked on the Danube, on the northern flank, by Slavs, and also to some extent by Avars, although the Avars are not so much pressing into the Balkans as they're robbers and bandits on trade going up and down the Balkans and across the Danube. So Byzantium is in some trouble. And in looking forward just a little bit, in Italy, the popes, I mean, actually everybody, but almost all of our sources emphasize the papacy, so that's sort of what we know most about. They're facing threats from the Lombards. Now, the Lombard pressure waxes and wanes. It's more intense in some moments and less intense in other moments, but it's always there. And of course, so the popes becoming, in a sense, spokesmen for Italy, also, of course, the exarchs of Ravenna, but because of theological quarrels with the East, Rome and the exarchs in Ravenna have been estranged from one another often, not always, but yeah, often. So an alliance between them is difficult. And so what Rome would actually like from Byzantium, from Constantinople, is help in Italy against the Lombards. What Constantinople wants is taxes from Italy to finance their wars against the Slavs and the Muslims.
Yeah.
So we have completely incompatible aims and intentions. And at the dawn of the 8th century, and this is one of those very interesting things, when I used to teach, I've been retired for some years, but when I was teaching, I would sometimes take students up to a certain point and I'd say, now, if we didn't know, what do you think was going to happen next? Well, if we take the year 700, 710, 720, you would never predict that the Franks were going to become prominent in Italy. There was no reason to suppose, Popes and Franks had very occasional, sporadic relationships for one or two centuries before this, but there was no sustained relationship. No appeals had gone to the Franks for help. The popes, the Franks, were not asking anything from Rome. So it would have seemed that Lombards, Byzantines, and popes were going to be the whole story. And yet, as we know, things evolved very differently. So as the 8th century dawned, it is sort of interesting, you know, to think, well, if we didn't know what was going to happen in the next decades, what would we predict? I don't think we'd predict what did finally happen.
Indeed. I agree about that. And it's, I think, from the point of view of the popes at the time, the by far the most likely scenario was the Lombards gaining the upper hand on the entire peninsula, and maybe them being relegated to being a very important Lombard bishop, and which is what they fear the most, I think.
Oh, I think that's because right. One of the interesting things about the early history of the papacy in general is so in the 4th century, when we could really begin to see the papacy emerging, there is virtually never an imperial government in Rome. Constantine has created a new capital in the east, and the Western emperors are in Ravenna, they're in Milan, they're in Trier in Germany, but they're not in Rome. So the popes have an opportunity to develop pretty independently, and there isn't there isn't a major force in the city that's against them. So I think by the 8th century, the popes had become quite accustomed to being autonomous. And so the idea of being imperial bishops, well, they didn't like that very much, but they certainly didn't want to become sort of Lombard chaplains. And so I think that
that's the main goal. Yeah, their main goal is that one. But in general, what they mean, the historians, when they say that there is a Frankish papacy or a Byzantine papacy in that sense, because you were explaining like at the beginning that there are two positions, basically saying some regard the birth of the papal states in pure Frankish terms. So basically, the popes are not independent until Charlemagne walks in, summarizing. And the Byzantine retort that it's really, the papacy can only be understood as an institution of the empire. Correct me if I'm wrong.
I think in general that characterizes the historiography. If you look at even say chapter titles or something like this, and a lot of the great books of the period, you know, Erich Kaspar's very famous History of the Papacy, Das Papstum unter Byzantinischer Herrschaft. That's his chapter. I mean, the popes are under Byzantine rule. Well, I've published elsewhere. Back up. So you've read the book, and one of the things that I do is a kind of a prosopography of some of these early popes, because part of the thesis about Byzantine control is that we have all of these Greek popes. Well, I study these popes. Sometimes their heritage was in the East, but they were born in Italy. They grew up in Italy. They've been in the papal administration for 20 years, and they do nothing that looks like they favor Constantinople. So
they may speak Greek, but they act as Roman bishop.
Exactly.
Right? That's kind of.
So these are some of the kinds of points that I tried to make, and I said, there's no evidence that they are loyal to or inclined to Byzantium. And then when, for example, in the 720s, the regime in Constantinople tries to raise taxes in Italy, it's the popes who raise up the Italians against paying the taxes. And the next thing you know, the exarch is coming down and trying to arrest the pope. But he failed. The Romans protect him. And the exarch is unable to capture him. So I think... in a way, what this really reflects is a heritage coming out of 19th century scholarship and especially German scholarship that tended to see everything in sort of very abstract constitutional terms. So what they're basically trying to claim is that constitutionally, Rome is still part of the empire, therefore the papacy is part of the empire. But my point is, if you look at the process culturally, if you look at the process politically, it's a very different story. Mm-hmm. So I've never accepted the idea that Byzantium was in very much control. Although I think until the 740s or 50s, you could say technically yes, Italy is still part of the empire. Now in 751, when Ravenna falls to the Lombards. Sure, the empire would like to have that back, but they never get it back. So then the other side of your question is the Frankish. If I'm right in how I read the evidence, the popes are moving in the 720s, 730s, and 740s towards separating themselves from any allegiance to Constantinople and instituting a separate, an independent, an autonomous regime. When Stephen II goes to the Frankish world to see Pippin, he is trying to gain recognition and protection for that new political entity. He is not going there to create it, and Pippin did not create it. And so 20 years later, Charlemagne did not create it. Charlemagne effectively guaranteed it. Largely, I think, by getting rid of Desiderius. Now, I've argued and I think people could disagree, but I've argued that Charlemagne's treatment of Desiderius was that he had seen his father struggle with the Lombards. And if we keep in mind that the Franks have got issues on their southern border along the Pyrenees, they've got issues mm-hmm. in Saxony, they've got issues with the Avars, they don't want to be tied down in Italy. And I think Charlemagne therefore comes in and says, look, what we have to do, we got to get rid of this guy. Just get rid of Desiderius. And I think that's, if we had the opportunity to hear some conversations between Charlemagne and Hadrian in 774, I think Charlemagne would have said to him, look, I got rid of Desiderius. You don't have any problems anymore. I have to go back to Francia. I have work to do. See you later.
See you later.
and he goes away. Now, I'm not really being silly. I mean, I think that's very close to what actually happened. So the idea that the Franks created the papal state, I don't believe that either. I think the popes did that. But what I think the Franks did is recognize it and agree to protect it.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And those are very important things, obviously. Very important.
So.
But they are not the creation. And it's really interesting how all this evolves over decades and decades. And where you start seeing this thing, I'm not entirely sure that even the popes knew what this thing was. And it's so one of the things, and this is my next question, because the title of your book is very is fantastic, The Republic of St. Peter. It captures the attention immediately, because republic, of course, in the sense of the Latin terms, right? The res publica, no? And also in capture the attention, but also uses a word that was used by Stephen II, nonetheless, to basically trying, if I understood correctly, to give a name to the thing, right? Mm-hmm. So I wanted to ask you basically to explain to my listeners how we got there and what Stephen II was trying to do with that.
Mm-hmm. No, that's a very good question. So the title, Republic of St. Peter, there is no papal document that explicitly uses that title, but mm-hmm. many papal documents explicitly use Res Publica, and they mm-hmm. explicitly mobilize St. Peter. Mm-hmm. So in a sense, for me to try to capture a sense of what was happening, I put those two things together. Now, what I think it meant, when the popes write to the Franks, they continually mobilize St. Peter. They say, come and protect St. Peter. Come and guarantee St. Peter's rights. Come and receive the heavenly intercession of St. Peter. I mean, again and again and mm-hmm. again, St. Peter. Now, a number of scholars have looked back deep into the 7th century even, and seen that, yes, St. Peter does have a certain purchase on the Franks, and there has been this kind of relationship. But it's really beginning with Gregory III that the popes begin to mobilize St. Peter. Now, one of the things that is interesting there, you'd also ask me a little bit about St. Peter's peculiar people.
Yeah.
So some years after I published this book, I published an article in which I looked at the way in papal correspondence down through the time of Hadrian, the popes used biblical language to talk to the Franks. Mm-hmm. So this was mm-hmm. this was basically their frame of discourse. How else were you going to talk to them? So they weren't going to go into deep Roman ideology or something like this. They're mobilizing.
They wouldn't understand, right?
Yeah, they're mobilizing biblical tropes. So St. Peter's peculiar people, the peculiaris populus, the peculiar people, appears in Deuteronomy 14, and it appears mm-hmm. again in the first letter of Peter. So mm-hmm. so the popes are, and isn't it interesting that the Deuteronomy passage appears in 1 Peter and the popes quote it to the Franks? And I mean, you can begin to see how I kept closing the circle on all of these things. So St. Peter's peculiar people are essentially the people who live in what had been the Exarchate of Ravenna. And the popes are now claiming these are St. Peter's people. And I am the vicar.
The Exarchate of Italy. I think you meant the Exarchate of Italy, not specifically Ravenna. So the entire area of the Exarchate.
Yes, exactly. Because the old Exarchate ran from Ravenna down to Rome. Rome was a duchy inside the Exarchate. But it was one administrative entity.
Exactly. Yes.
And this is the people to whom the popes are laying claim. These are our people. These are our special people because they're St. Peter's people. So
they are St. Peter's people. It's Imperial Italy, basically. It's Imperial Italy. So is in that do you think is excluding Lombard Italy from that?
Well, I mean that's very interesting. Because, you know, we could go all the way back, say, into the 6th century and look at the three chapters controversy and different things. Mm-hmm. So the popes are always trying to maintain a certain kind of theological precedence, but not really an administrative precedence in other parts of Italy, north or south, for that matter.
Yeah.
And we have no document anywhere where the popes lay claim to essentially Lombard Italy. Now, maybe we'll talk about this a little bit later. When we do begin to have the documents that show us what the popes claimed and what the Franks guaranteed, you know, there are one or two papal claims that you had asked about this. For example, Venice, the popes wanted Venice. They never got Venice. The Franks never assigned them Venice. Yeah. Ravenna itself was kind of curious. I mean, I called that a double diarchy or a double condominium. Sort of the Franks and the patriarchs of Ravenna shared power, and the popes and the patriarchs of Ravenna shared power. Ravenna was simply too complicated to be handed over, and I think the Ravennati would never have accepted
it. They didn't want it, right? So maybe the Pope wanted it, but it's that Ravennati have always been trying to resist tooth and nail.
Yes, no, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, Ravenna is a very proud city, a very ancient city. It was in the 4th and 5th centuries an imperial city. So anyway, you know, there is no evidence that, there's no evidence that the Regno, the northern Italian Lombard kingdom, was ever claimed by the popes. There is that strange Luni Monselice line that runs across the map, and historians have puzzled over, well, did that come from a 7th century treaty, or where did that line come from? And finally, we don't know for sure, but nothing north of that line was ever claimed. Now, in later times, the popes did lay claim to Lombard Tuscany, the lower part of Tuscany, the part of Tuscany that actually borders the old Duchy of Rome. It is true that at different times, the popes tried to lay claims to the duchies of Spoleto and Benevento. And the Franks never let them have Spoleto. They did get some territory up in the Sabine Hills. So in the Sabina, and of course the Sabina territory wound up as one of the states of the Papal States in the late Middle Ages, right down to the 19th century. Got all of Spoleto. And Benevento is interesting because at different times in later centuries, a large part of what had been the Lombard Duchy of Benevento was actually claimed by and ruled by the popes. But they didn't get it in the Carolingian period. That came later on. So those would be two pieces of the Lombard world that the popes did lay claim to and possessed some part of, or sometimes possessed some part of. But the north, they never laid claim to it.
Yeah. The maximum, to simplify, the maximum extent of their claim was this Luni Monselice line.
Basically.
Which basically runs its peninsular Italy with a bit of addition, including the Romagna, so the area of the Exarchate of Ravenna. Simplifying.
That's basically, it's a sort of a diagonal stripe running from northeast to southwest.
So basically, Imperial Italy, Tuscany, Spoleto and Benevento. That was the maximum extent of their claim. And this comes out at the time of the first important treaty or agreement between the Franks and the papacy, and in this extraordinary trip and visit to Francia. Do you want to explain what do you think happened there?
Well, so Stephen has found himself in a very awkward position because the Lombard king has now in 751 conquered Ravenna and is marching toward Rome. So
yeah.
For the Lombards, there was always this very complicated problem that when the kingdom was established, really towards the end of the 6th century, the Lombards did not come into Italy as one large unified group. They came in as many smaller groups over a period of time, and their kings early on were probably only leaders of kind of one small group. And from a historical point of view, the crucial thing is that two significant groups went much further south, went to Spoleto and to Benevento. And yeah. The duchies of Spoleto and Benevento were very independent. They did not want to be ruled from Pavia. They didn't want to be ruled by the Lombard kings in the north. Now, you have this diagonal stripe across Italy of imperial land that we just talked about, or later on of papal land. If the king in Pavia wants to control Spoleto and Benevento, he has to march across that territory.
Yeah.
And
that's what Liuprando,
did
several times.
Exactly. And of course, Gregory II and Gregory III, and then also Zachary, engaged very complicated diplomacy with the dukes of Spoleto and Benevento. And the dukes of Spoleto and Benevento were not really pro-papal. They were anti Liutprand. So when it suited their interest to ally with the Pope, they would do that. And when it didn't suit their interest, they wouldn't do that. So the Lombard kings were in a somewhat difficult position. Well, then when Ravenna falls to them, and the pressure is placed right on the city of Rome. You know, we have these stories of the Lombards come in and tonsuring Romans in the Lombard style, mm-hmm. and so forth. What is Stephen going to do? Well, he first appeals to Constantinople, and mm-hmm. Constantinople tells him to negotiate with the Lombards. Well,
yeah, natural, no? That's the natural answer to that problem.
Sure,
right?
Because you know the Byzantines have no troops, have no money, have no resources to come to Italy and help the Bishop of Rome. They just don't. And so Stephen, decides that he will. So there's Frankish envoys in Rome, and they're negotiating, and Stephen is invited to come to the Frankish world. He goes north, and as I worked out the chronology, he spent nearly 2 weeks in Pavia. Now, yeah. There's no evidence that he was a captive or a prisoner. So I think he was negotiating. He didn't want to go to Francia. He didn't want to go see the Franks. I don't think there was any animosity. But the point is, he would have liked to have settled the issue in Italy itself. Well, I've always wondered, why did Ratcliffe let Stephen leave and go to Francia?
Me too. It's incredible. If you think about it,
yeah.
It's incredible. Because you have this Pope, you know that if he's going to Francia, he's no good at absolutely for you. So why would you let him go? I think you meant Aistulf.
Aistulf, yes. I said Ratcliffe. I'm sorry. I meant Aistulf, yes.
It's okay. It's okay. I'm just saying,
No, no, no. I just misspoke.
It's normal. It happens all the time. So there's a lot. But yeah, but it's Aistulf or Aistulf. And he lets him go, knowing full well what will happen, I think. So what do you think are the possibilities there? So why did he let him go? Maybe he couldn't keep him.
So, I mean, this is interesting, and no source tells us explicitly. So what we have to do is make educated guesses.
Yeah,
I think first of all, capturing, imprisoning something the Pope would have been a real outrage, and I think that Aistulf is wise enough to know that his position is tenuous. If he really wants to incorporate central Italy, that's an interesting question. Or does he want simply free passage through central Italy to go to Spoleto and Benevento? So he doesn't want to commit an outrage. But I think just as important, and I think actually in the long run, Desiderius wound up making the same mistake. I think Aistulf made a kind of a wager that the Franks were not going to do anything significant to help the Pope. You know, the Franks and the Lombards actually had been allies in the 720s and 730s.
Yeah, with Charles Martel and Liutprand, they were allies
against
the Arabs and in general. And the Pope was really furious about.
You know, I think, well, at the very inception of that relationship between the Lombards and the Franks, I don't think the popes were thinking too much about it because the wheel had not turned enough for the popes to say, I think maybe we're going to have to talk to these Franks. So in 739, when Gregory writes to Gregory III writes two letters to the Franks, I think these are, you know, what we would call trial balloons. He's trying to see what kind of reaction he might get.
Will you be there if I need you, right?
And you know, he's been talking to Boniface, all of this. I mean, he and his predecessors had been talking to Boniface, who after all has visited Rome three times. So again, part
missionary
of the
missionary in Germany, let me explain, missionary in Germany for big connection with the papacy, but working in the Frankish realm, so a realistic bridge between the two.
No, exactly. And I think in answer to your question, I think Aistulf was reluctant to commit an outrage, but I think he was also wagering that not much was going to happen.
Yeah.
And I don't think that was a foolish wager. I mean, in retrospect, we can see that he was wrong. But Stephen goes north. Now, you know, Stephen is obviously very anxious. He crosses the Alps in the dead of winter.
Yeah.
You don't usually do that.
No. Not even today is very comfortable. So imagine at the time. And no pope had ever done that. So we have to highlight how extraordinary this is.
Absolutely.
No pope. Popes went to Constantinople every now and then, but never been across the Alps.
No, exactly. And so then, you know, Stephen kind of makes his way up to the Franks in stages. He spends some time just on the north side of the Alps. Then he goes a bit further north. Then he spends part of the winter at Saint-Denis. And then he's having meetings at Pontion and meetings in Quercy. And one of the things that, again, one could wish that our sources were richer, were more detailed, but there were continuous negotiations and discussions, and we're not privy to everything that was being discussed.
Yeah,
what we know from sources that are a little bit later, but what we seem to know is that Stephen is now laying claim to this about one third of Italy. Which I'm calling the Republic of St. Peter, but he's calling a republic and he's calling it the lands of St. Peter, the rights of St. Peter, and so on. And he wants recognition and protection for that. I mean, he explicitly asks for protection. Come and protect St. Peter. He doesn't say protect me. He says come and protect St. Peter and St. Peter's peculiar people. Well, that has to be these people from sort of Ravenna to Campania. And so that's what he wants. Now, what's in it for Pippin? First of all, it's important to remember that Pippin's a usurper.
Yeah. Just a very recent usurper.
A very recent usurper. And as we know from a few instances earlier, for example, in the 8th century, when there were contested successions in the Frankish world, as we know from even in 768, when Charles and his brother have to divide up Pippin's kingdom, there's tension between them. So not everyone in the Frankish world was happy with Pippin's...
Was on board with the Pippinids, because... They were used to having the Merovingians rule of be the lord of the kingdom, and all suddenly, just a few years prior, Pippin had finally taken the big step of becoming de jure king, not de facto only.
No, exactly. And as a number of scholars, especially say my old friend Ian Wood, have demonstrated, the caricature that Einhard drew of the late Merovingians has become standard in the scholarship. So it's as if these kings were just useless, they were worthless, they were incompetent, and good old Pippin comes along and straightens things out. Well, in point of fact, the later Merovingians were not so terrible, and there was a great deal of legitimacy that attached to them. So, yeah.
Three centuries of legitimacy. That's so a pretty...
Pippin's step was really, in many ways, a dangerous one. So for him to gain some kind of recognition. Now, that has led, as you know, I mean, some scholars to talk about a kind of a quid pro quo. You know, Pippin says, okay, you take care of my kingship and I'll take care of your Republic of St. Peter. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, there is something to that, but I think that oversimplifies the matter. I think further that, you know, it's many months before Pippin can make a promise to come to Italy and persuade the Franks to come to Italy. These things, you know, if you look at kind of what's going on over the course of 754, it works out over several months. It's not sort of decisions being made just right away, bang, bang.
Yeah,
bang.
Let's go. And there's even resistance from what I remember Franks.
I think there was. And so, you know, no Frankish army had ever marched into Italy. They can't have known what was in it for them. You know, if we think, let's say in the 820s, when poor Louis the Pious gets himself in trouble with the Franks because he wants to campaign in Brittany. And in a way, the Franks don't want to campaign in Brittany because the Bretons, first of all, they fight like guerrillas. They don't make, you know, pitched battles. They just attack you every place you don't expect it. And also, Brittany's very poor. There's not great spoils to get there. So I think, you know, in the 750s, there would have been enough uncertainty. And then there may have been Franks who felt, look, we were just allies with these Lombards. Why do you want to go to war with them? So I think Pippin was in a very awkward and delicate position. So it's again, you know, if we were to play the game, if we stop history at this moment, what do you think is happening next? You know, the odds of Pippin going to Italy were not great. But but then, of course, he does. He goes, and he winds up having to go twice. And essentially hands over the former exarchate to the Pope. And when he meets those Byzantine ambassadors who'd been coming to Rome and then coming up to see him, and he tells them that he gave all of this land to St. Peter. He didn't say he gave it to the Pope. He said he gave it to St. Peter for the remission of his sins. Now, those clever Byzantine diplomats must have been shocked. how can anybody be so naive? How can anybody do such a thing? But that's what Pippin said. Now, should we completely dismiss that? I don't think so. I don't think so. I think, you know, on
he committed a lot of sins, so he may have actually felt. I mean, the Frankish kings will build enormous monasteries. To atone their sins, right? To try to atone their sins. So it's a way of building an enormous monastery in the most prestigious place of them all, right? In Rome, and giving it to St. Peter, right? So that is really fascinating in that sense.
No, I agree completely. So I think, you know, what is important to understand about the events of 754.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Are that, that both parties were negotiating from positions of weakness and uncertainty.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had to work out a deal, let it say, that, that worked well for both of them.
And they could stand the test of time.
Exactly. And then Vatican City is still there. So, I mean, obviously what they did has stood the test of time. And, you know, it's not protected by Frankish kings anymore or something, but...
But it was protected by Frankish kings all the way down to 1870, so it's a pretty long run.
No, that's right. I mean, there were, French soldiers down there during the Italian reunification, so...
Indeed. Until Napoleon III was defeated by the Prussians, and then he had to withdraw the troops. That's how Italy got Rome. But anyway, we are... Yep. Going in another direction. One question that I bit of skipped, but you know, I wanted to get it here, mm-hmm. there, and seeing this thing from the point of view of the Lombards a bit. So, what Liutprand, Aistulf, were trying, and then even Desiderius, three very, I will say, three capable kings, mm-hmm. with all their faults, what they were trying to achieve in that sense? Do you think they? Because the Pope clearly feared that they would conquer Rome. Mm-hmm. But do you think they were trying to do that? And of course, the policy may be different king by king, mm-hmm. because Liutprand may be very different from Aistulf, from Aistulf.
I think, one thing is, you know, for the earlier period, we have the narrative of Paul the Deacon. But he mm-hmm. stops in 744 when Liutprand dies.
Yeah,
and we have no really valuable Lombard chronicle to take us through the rest of the story. We have some things that are written later, kind of looking back.
With insight, though, right?
So one of the things we cannot do is get inside the head of Liutprand or Aistulf or Desiderius. Obviously. So we have to sort of try to make sense of what happened. Now, I think, for example, with Liutprand, who I wish we knew more about Liutprand. I have a very strong feeling that Liutprand was actually a very capable man. And, you know, art historians are discovering interesting examples of art in the Northern Kingdom during this period of time. There are, I mean, heaven knows there's arguments about it, but those absolutely gorgeous paintings at Castel Seprio, for example.
Fantastic, yeah.
Things like this. The very fine sculpture begins to reappear. This requires patronage.
Yeah.
And you know, there are people like Johnny Mitchell, for example, who have even argued that we need to think hard about the so-called Carolingian Renaissance, that it isn't all Carolingian things moving to Italy, but Italian things moving north.
So I
think if we knew more about Liutprand, his might be a very, very interesting reign indeed, but we just can't make all the connections. I think at a minimum, they were trying to gain control of Spoleto and Benevento. Whether they had grander aspirations, whether they actually wanted to go to the toe of the Italian boot, as one of the Frankish sort of hostile writers says, I don't know. I don't see particular evidence of that. Their problem, of course, was that until 751, they've got the exarchs and the popes, and after 751, they've got the popes preventing them from gaining access to Spoleto and Benevento. If they had incorporated Rome into their kingdom, what would that have meant exactly? So if the popes feared becoming kind of Lombard court chaplains, is that what the Lombards were thinking? I don't know. I don't know how to know that.
It's impossible to know. But my impression reading all this, and this is only my impression as an absolute I mean, I'm not a scholar, obviously, but the impression I got is that Liutprand thought about the papacy and we will keep you, you can keep Rome. That's my impression. But Ravenna, Perugia, Spoleto, Benevento, that's not Rome. And, you know, I can get that because, and I will, you know, you'll be safe in Rome. I will deposit my weapons and at the tomb of St. Peter and pay all my respect and make sure that you understand that. But the rest that is not the dukedom, what is not the dukedom of Rome? So I have this feeling that there is basically a difference, simplifying it, about Ravenna, basically, simplifying it, where Aistulf and Liutprand definitely want Ravenna, and the Pope definitely don't want them there, in a sense.
Well, I think that's right. I think the popes were not prepared to cede any territory, because not even a
castle.
No, because I think their fear was that. If anything were lost, everything would be lost. But what exactly the Lombards themselves hope to do is more difficult to say, because, I mean, basically, virtually everything we know about the Lombards comes from sources that are hostile to them.
Yeah.
And it doesn't give them any credit. Now, marching an army toward Rome to bring pressure on Rome, that was done the first time in 390 BC. But we've seen that kind of thing all over history. Sometimes you bring pressure to gain a particular result, but the result you're aiming for is not to capture what you're threatening at the moment. Yeah. They would have, you know, said to the popes, well, you can have the Duchy of Rome. You keep that. We want everything else. Or whether, I mean, for example, let's say if Gregory III or even Zachary had said, okay, you can have free passage through Perugia. You can cross at Perugia, cross the Apennines and go into Spoleto. That's fine. You can do that. Would that have been enough? I don't know.
Yeah, there's no way. Unfortunately, there's no way of knowing.
So I think it's just hard to know.
Yeah, no, obviously. And we are all talking about what we can know, obviously, and I try to see what we can infer, let's say. I find it also interesting, Desiderius, because, we just talked about the fact that Pepin absolutely destroyed Aistulf twice. And so how do you recover from that? And yet, Desiderius really, really tried and even seemed to manage for a while. He even seems to have had a plan to dominate the Republic, what we have defined as the Republic. And I find it... So, do you want to talk us about that and what was the reaction of the Romans?
Well, the case of Desiderius really is interesting because, you know, it appears that he offered some guarantees to the Franks, which he then violated. He appears to have offered some guarantees to the popes, which he then violated. And so, in part, it seems to me that like Pippin, like Aistulf before him, he's wagering that the Franks are not going to come back to Italy, are not going to threaten him. You know, now, when we look at papal correspondence in the 760s, there's less of it than there is in the time of Hadrian later, or even than there had been in the 5 years of Stephen's pontificate. But the popes are continually writing to the Franks and basically asking for help because Desiderius has not handed over one palm's breadth of land and all of this sort of thing.
And always the same, yes.
And they're using the same language. And Desiderius must know that the popes are constantly asking for help and not getting any. So I think, he may be thinking, well, you know, the Franks have pretty much done what they're going to do. Then there's that whole amazingly complicated set of developments in Rome in 767, 8, and 9. Desiderius is clearly trying to get some people in Rome under his influence without capturing the city. You know, he's working with parties, with factions.
within Rome. Yeah,
exactly. And then we have the whole strange business with Duke Toto of Nepi and all of that, which is going on. One of the things that I think we see in that brief period at the end of the 760s is a result of the emergence of this autonomous sort of independent papal republic. If this is the case, then a career in the Byzantine administration is now off the table. There would be no appointments, military, administrative, whatever. So the papal government is going to become the only game in town.
Yeah.
And we're also beginning to see, I think, the emergence of certain factions. You know, it's very interesting the way the Liber Pontificalis stresses how Stephen and his brother Paul are Romans. I mean, that's really important to them. And as we know, they come from probably an aristocratic family. So now a certain kind of Roman nobility is taking over. But, I mean, in the city of Rome, right until this morning, there are controversy or quarrels among all the great families. So we know that, and we can see right through the pontificate of Hadrian, we can see when Hadrian dies during the pontificate of Leo, and heaven knows all the decades of the 9th century, we can see the Roman families fighting with each other for control of the city. Well, okay, so enough of that. I think Desiderius can see all of that, and he may think that this is a very complicated situation from which he can draw some profit.
Yeah.
And but behind that, as I say, I have a hunch that he wagered that Charlemagne would not come back to Italy, that Pippin would not come to Italy until he dies in 768. And then Desiderius probably knows that there's some controversy in the Frankish world as the Frankish realm is divided between between Charles and his brother. And is my reconstruction of events. I can't point to specific sources that say exactly that.
obviously. But it's very, very interesting because it seems like if the Franks would have not united, behind Charles, it seems that wager, you know, was a pretty good one, you know, because they were really busy dealing with each other.
No, I think that's right.
So let's go to the Carolingian settlement, because this is really interesting. So I will skip the part about the organization of the Republic. So I'll talk about that in a separate episode. I go a bit in details about that. Maybe we can come back if we have time. But the Carolingian settlement is interesting in that sense that you traced an evolution of the settlement between the Carolingians, what we call the Carolingians, obviously, the Carolingians and the papacy, starting with Charles and Hadrian, and going forward, which is in phases, right? We have the Hadrian phase, then we have the imperial coronation, and then we have the Louis the Pious phase, if I can summarize. Do you want to tell us basically how those differ? Let's say these three moments of time, because here we are seeing how it's evolving the role of the papacy within the Carolingian world. Not the Carolingian realm, but within the Carolingian world.
Okay, so I mean, one of the things that I tried to do was understand the territorial dimension of this whole problem.
That's very interesting. By the way, very interesting.
Well, thank you. When we look at the sources for the promises of the 750s, one of the things that is striking is that they are not very precise. They don't tell us a lot of details. Then we have the passage in the Liber Pontificalis in the life of Hadrian. And, of course, there are a number of scholars who think that this is an interpolation or that it's even maybe a forgery. I don't think that's the case. But anyway, we don't have to track that story down. We do now have a little bit more detail. And the biographer of Hadrian says that the document that Charles placed on the Confessio of St. Peter was written ad instar interioris, as a copy of the previous one. Well, the problem is that those particular sources just don't tell us enough in concrete detail. So when do we have some detail? Well, in the document we call the Pactum Ludovicianum. Now, here, we know that after the imperial coronation, the Franks and the popes kind of renew their alliance with every change in office.
Yeah. And one of them, one of the two changed, and then they will keep renewing it.
Exactly. And of course, that continues for centuries in the Middle Ages. So that's it starts here, but it's not it doesn't stop there. So the pactum is probably created in the time of Stephen the Fourth, but the version we have is the one from the beginning of Paschal the First. So there's no reason to suppose that there would have been any change in just like 1 or 2 years in the shape of the document. The document is in two parts. One part kind of spells out some rights and responsibilities and duties, but the longer part is an accounting of the territories that the Franks agreed.
Very detailed. Down to the small town, basically.
And among other things interesting about this is that we have no contemporary manuscript. The best version of it is from the work of the papal official Cencius in the 1190s, and he included the Ludovicianum in a document which is the basis for Pope Innocent III attempting the recuperations of the papal states, territories that have been lost in the intervening centuries. But anyway, so we have this document. So then some people have said, well, maybe the document was changed in the 1190s when they're writing it down. I don't think it's necessary to make that argument. So if you look at the lands in the Ludovicianum, and you look at the passage in the Liber Pontificalis biography of Hadrian, there are some differences. So I asked myself, can we possibly explain these differences? Can we possibly understand how they came about? And one of the things that I discover is that, you know, Charles has some officials kind of going around Italy in 778, 9, and 80. 781, he goes to Rome. You know, his one son is baptized. His sons are made kings of Italy and Aquitaine and so on. And it seems to me that's one time when Charlemagne makes a first set of settlements. These are mostly towards the north. Then 787, Charlemagne's back in Italy because he's got problems with the Duke of Benevento. So he's in the south. And now we also see that comparing the documents again, that there are some differences in the south. So in the Liri Valley, in the valley of the river Liri, basically Charlemagne adds some territory in Campania that had not been in the original claims. So, you know, Hadrian got a little bit that he hadn't claimed or that Pippin hadn't claimed, but he didn't get Spoleto and Benevento sub integro. He didn't get them.
Basically, you are saying it's a could be like a compensation. You're not getting everything, but I'm giving you something.
That's how I understand it, because I mean I attempted to explain carefully in the book what the changes look like between the document of 774 and the document of 817. So how do we get from one to the other? So I tried to understand that from political point of view, from territorial point of view, and my explanation is that the Franks were basically saying some things we can give you, some things we can't give you, and so for instance they were not going to give them Venice. That was I mean at that time the Franks themselves don't control Venice. I've actually written a little piece on Venice a long time ago because, you know, there's an historiography on Venice, as you probably know, that, well, was it pro-Frankish? Was it pro-Papal? Was it pro-Byzantine? And I looked at all of that and I said, no. You have to understand the Venetians are pro-Venetian.
Yes. As they always were.
Exactly. So nobody was controlling Venice. So that was not going to be. And Istria Istria appears in the early documents. I think that at the time, can we take what's in the Liber Pontificalis biography of Hadrian as strictly accurately reflecting what was decided in 754? I don't know. It's hard for me to imagine why certain changes would have been made. I think probably, Pippin had never been to Italy. Charlemagne had never been to Italy. So
they didn't know what they were giving or taking.
Exactly.
In that sense.
That is my very firm impression. So I think the popes were trying to make the grandest claims they could. To go back to your earlier question, it's interesting they never claimed the Lombard Regno.
Yeah.
They're claiming Venice. They're claiming Istria. They never got Istria. They're claiming Spoleto and Benevento, Subintegro, holy. They want the whole thing. Well, yeah. They get a bit of the Sabine Hills, but they don't get any more of Spoleto.
Yeah, yeah. Liri Valley, the Sabine Hills. So for my listeners, of course, we are talking about southern Latium today and northern Latium, Umbria today, basically. These are very small areas, which are contiguous to the main area of, and they were even at times in Imperial Italy. So I think the Liri Valley was only conquered by the Dukes of Benevento in early 700s.
I think that's
so,
right.
So that there is a basis, right, to give it. To give them that, because they're saying, okay, this belonged to you not so long ago, so here is it back in that sense. But you're not getting old Benevento. Forget about it.
and then if the Luni Monselice line that appears in the Liber Pontificalis biography of Hadrian, if that is accurate, then what's interesting there, of course, is that the territory that we call Lombard Tuscany, in other words, the part of Tuscany south of that line and up to the border of the Duchy of Rome, this is an addition because that was never part of the Duchy of Rome. And so that piece of territory was carved off of the Lombard kingdom and given to Rome, but right next door, Rome only got the Sabine Hills. They didn't get all of Spoleto. And they get essentially the saddle over the mountains. They get Perugia and they get the Pentapolis, which in later times would be the March of Ancona, but they get the Pentapolis, but they don't get Ravenna strictly. They get some authority, some influence, some rights, but they don't get Ravenna. So what I tried to show was a process of negotiation and a process of territorial settlement that I think was, at the end of the day, fair to everybody.
And in any negotiation, you know, your first opening, of course, is bigger than what you are. It's higher than what you are willing to accept, right? So the Pope says, "I'll take all of that," and says, "Let's negotiate until
exactly, and it's perfectly understandable. And it is interesting that the Pactum Ludovicanum serves centuries later as the basis for Pope Innocent III to try to start recovering the Papal States. So
the Papal States, right? After this is not, and then even after the Avignon period, the same thing. You know, they're always rebasing the claim on this. This is what was granted, and we're not gonna give one piece, one square mile of this away.
Sure. the Papal States grew and shrunk and grew and shrunk many, many times until 1871. But this basic core from the 8th century is the very heart of it the whole time. So,
and so very important agreement. And one last thing maybe is about the Constitutio Romana, because here we can talk maybe about the inner workings of Rome. It seems that my impression reading your books and also others is that the Franks at the time of Charlemagne would have been happy to leave the entire governance of Rome and how to elect popes and all that to Rome. They didn't want to get involved. But at the end, with this document, the Constitution Romana, the time of Louis the Pious, they do get involved. So what is your impression about that?
Well, I think you're right. This document does mark a certain kind of change. When you look at Charlemagne, you could say, well, okay, he goes down there in November and December of 800 and holds a big synod or something to judge Leo to see what's going on. I mean, the Franks did everything in their power not to judge Leo and make him stand up. So in other words, I'm just agreeing with you. The Franks showed no interest in taking over Rome, in governing Rome, in ruling Rome. We know from diplomatic sources that they are collecting taxes in Lombard Italy, but we don't know that they ever took any money out of the Papal States, Republic of St. Peter, whatever one wants to call it. So in the institutional parts of the Pactum Ludovicianum, which is the version we have from 817, what I argued is that the Franks created something rather like an immunity. Now, an immunity document in the Frankish world basically said, if I grant you immunity, that means that my officials are never going to enter your land, but you and I have a relationship, and I can make demands upon you. I can ask for soldiers for my army. I can ask for some taxes, whatever it might be. So what happens in 817 is the Franks are basically trying to say, we're going to have a very deep, a very powerful personal and spiritual relationship with you, the Frankish Emperor and the Pope. But for the most part, we're not going to interfere with your daily business. Well, within a couple of years, you've got Paschal being accused of murdering papal officials, and obviously, things have gone very, very wrong in Rome. So then we get the Constitutio Romana. So here the scholarship, the historiography, again, is very interesting. So there's particularly an older generation of scholars. They want to attribute this to Lothar because they think Louis the Pious is so weak and feckless and incompetent that he never would have taken this bold step. So it must have been his son Lothar. Well, I mean, that's, I think, crazy. An emperor didn't let his son go off and do major things like this. Then the question is this a 180 degrees change from the earlier time? Well, here again, good scholars can disagree. Some think that this is the Carolingian saying, okay, actually, we really do have to control Rome and everything. I think that what they tried to do was maintain as much as they could of this sort of quasi-immunity from 817. What they do is they say, we're going to put an official in Rome, and the Pope is going to name an official, and the two of them together are going to collaborate to make sure, first of all, that papal elections are legitimate, and second, that no one is deprived of his rights. So there is a recognition and acknowledgement that everything is not okay in Rome, and that Frankish protection may have to take a little more concrete form. But I don't think the Constitutio Romana represented a sort of a Carolingian takeover. I think it's an adjustment of what we saw in 817. Now, there are people who disagree with me about that, and that's fair. I mean, the language of the document is sufficiently ambiguous that
you can interpret it in different ways.
So I've just shared my own view of what happened, but I think others can see the document in slightly different terms. What happens going forward, of course, all the way down to the Ottonianum in 962 and the Henricianum in 1024, there's another five or six papal imperial meetings that are documented with something like the Constitutio Romana or something like the Ludovicianum. But in almost all those cases, except for the Ottonianum and the Henricianum, in almost all those other cases, the document doesn't survive. We know they met. We know they talked about this, that, and the other thing, but the document doesn't survive. So one can also, and I've done some of this, I wrote a long article for the Cambridge History of the Papacy, which is in press right now, about I call it the first papal state. So the one from 750 to 1305, when the popes leave for Avignon. And some of what I did with the Ludovicianum, looking back to 774 and 754, I also took the Ottonianum and looked back, and the Henricianum and looked back to see what's similar, what's different. How can we think about, how can we explain the changes? So none of these Carolingian documents was definitive. They were always subject to further review and further adjustment. It's impressive when you go all the way to the Ottonianum and the Henricianum, so to the middle of the 10th century and then to the early 11th century, the changes were pretty small territorially. Mm-hmm. And yet what we know from the political history of Italy is that those claims were more and more an aspiration. The popes didn't really control all that territory.
They didn't control anything beyond even the dukedom of Rome at times they didn't control.
Yeah, they controlled that fairly well, but beyond that, their control was stronger sometimes, weaker sometimes, contested almost everywhere.
Every city tried to resist. But what you're saying is that every emperor kind of confirmed with changes due to passage of time. You know, we were in a very different situation by the time of the Ottonians, obviously. Mm-hmm. But they tried to maintain that continuity where there is something in Rome. They have agreed the borders of it. It's an aspiration, as you're saying. Sometimes you're never going to control it exactly, but we confirm that that's what is written on the paper, basically.
No, exactly. In 769, in the Roman Synod, Roman Synod held that year, one of the provisions was that popes would henceforth be elected by the cardinal clergy.
Ah, very interesting, now, this one. Very, very interesting.
And
because
this also,
before they weren't, let's explain that.
They were
before they weren't. The militia and the people, whatever that means.
By the clergy and people of Rome.
Yeah.
And so, the clergy, okay, we have a pretty good sense of who that means. Probably the title priests and the major deacons and what have you. We can see plenty of evidence of that. Exactly. What role did the people play? Who were the people? Because, I mean, clero et populo Romanorum. You know, it's hard to say. Now, in the Ludovicianum, one of the things that Louis insisted upon, the people were put back in the electoral process. They don't get booted out again until the 11th century.
Yeah.
So the people are put back in the electoral process, and immediately we've got violence in the streets of Rome. So then we get a papal official and an imperial official who are supposed to guarantee that the papal election has been legitimate. Mm-hmm. It's interesting that the Franks do not claim the right to approve the election as the Byzantine emperors had had. You know,
yeah.
So there is a change in other words, this represents a kind of a change. You know, the Franks at first say, "Look, let's let the Roman people back into the election." I think probably part of that is the attacks on Leo III at the beginning and the end of his pontificate. And then,
Leo III is the pope, just to explain to my listeners, is the pope that coronates.
Charlemagne,
crowns,
that's right. He's Pope
Charlemagne, and he's the pope that also was attacked just before the coronation. So we're talking about something very delicate is happening during his papacy. He has a lot. He's not a nobleman, so he's coming from the slightly lower strata of the population, and he's not accepted by the nobleman. Simplifying, if you agree about that.
Yeah. Well,
and then the answer of Louis the Pious after Charlemagne is to put back the people of Rome in the electoral process. So he was clearly trying to achieve something, you know, in vis-a-vis the election, make them more legitimate, maybe, so more acceptable for everyone in Rome. What do you think he was trying to do?
Well, I mean, it's an interesting question. And again, one is sort of left to speculate. But I think, I think that given the violence during the pontificate of Leo III, when the for example, at the end of Leo's pontificate, his estates, the Domus Cultae out in the countryside around Rome, are attacked. In 799, of course, Leo is on a liturgical process through the city, and he's attacked. And the leaders supposedly are Paschalus and Capulus, who are aristocrats and relatives of Hadrian. So we're seeing this factionalism inside the papal government. And I suspect what we have there is if the cardinal clergy are going to elect, a great many of the priests of Rome must not have been sympathetic to the aristocrats. And they elect somebody like Leo, and so then the aristocrats object, and they fire back. So in 817, when Louis is creating the Pactum Ludwigianum, I think what he's saying is, let's let the people back in this process, because if they're excluded, we're going to have violence every time, because they're going to attack popes and heaven knows what. And
in this case, the people means probably mostly the noblemen, as you are saying.
Probably. It would be lovely to know concretely what does populus mean. There were no elections indeed, as in modern times or something like that. But, you know, we can go all the way back to where we first have some reasonable evidence for elections of the bishops of Rome. In other words, into the third century. And we can see laity and clergy both participating. But again, we can get pretty close to understanding who the clergy were, although interestingly, that far back, the deacons appear to have been more prominent than the priests. But we still don't know who the people were. What does that mean?
And what do they do? Do they acclaim like they do for the emperors? So they basically, others choose and then they just have to applaud?
This is what we never see. We never see that part of it.
It's very frustrating because it would be I think most people don't know that actually popes for such a long time, as you are saying, they're not booted out until the 11th century, that for so long, the people of Rome, the lay people, so the people that are not in the church, were deciding who the bishop of Rome will be, or they had a strong, important role in that. And it would be really nice to know how that happened. But unfortunately, we don't.
No, that's exactly right. It's I used to always tell my students that history is like a fisherman's net. What we know are the strings, and what we don't know are all the holes.
All the holes, exactly. We can only infer some of that, but without knowing. Professor, you've given me an hour and a half of your time. I could stay another three, but I would really like to thank you, because this is, for me, this is going to be basically welcome to the 8th century episode. Look what's ahead. And I think you have given everyone lots of thoughts of, you know, how interesting this period. I mean, I will say this is probably one of the most consequential changes in the history of the West, where you really see sliding doors going in a way or in another, not to quote a movie. Really thank you for your time.
No, I'm delighted to be able to do it. I was just thinking my book appeared 40 years ago.
It's been a while,
I've continued to think about these subjects and to write a little bit about them and so forth.
As I was saying, everyone still quoting all the time, books written last year still saying, Republics of St. Peter, you want to get an... I have it somewhere now, I can't find it, but Barbero, for example, I had it. I had others Gasparri. So to talk about important, and they always say, if you want to understand how Rome worked, I mean, what we can understand about the functioning of Rome in the 8th century, that's the book. So thank you. Thank you so much.
You know, I'm very happy to be able to participate in a show about Storia d'Italia, because I was very happy when the Library of Congress cataloging system in the United States put a DG on my book, because that means it's Italian history, not papal history. I really wanted people to say that what I've done is I've made a contribution to the history of Italy, not simply to the church or to the popes.
To the popes. And I absolutely agree with that, because that is also the way you put it at the beginning, is putting Italy back in this story. Like you're saying, you know, when we're saying about the historiography, the Frankish and the Byzantine, no? So looking at it from, which are obviously very important, but it's like taking away the agency of the people that lived in Italy. I'm not talking that it's in any nationalistic term, but the people lived in Italy have agency, both in Lombardy Italy, in Papal Italy, and they are trying to build their story as well. And it's very interesting to see how they navigated these most troubling of times, where things really were in a flux. But I agree, it's absolutely History of Italy. There is a translation in Italian for people that are interested. La Repubblica di San Pietro, obviously. So if you want to read the book in Italian, it's available.
Yes, and I'm sorry, my Italian is not good enough to make this interview in Italian.
It's okay.
I'd have to stop and think all the time what to say next, so...
I say if it's possible, because sometimes you know I'm surprised by people knowing Italian, but no, thank you so much.
Thank you.
E come dico in questi casi, questo è quanto. La prossima settimana tornerà il podcast principale con ovviamente una nuova puntata, la 152. Vedrete che facciamo l'ultima corsa verso la fine del VII secolo, entrando anche già nell'VIII. Penso che le prossime quattro puntate con le quali arriveremo alla fine della narrazione del secolo siano molto appassionanti e un vero trailer di quello che avverrà nel prossimo secolo. Quanto a Storia d'Italia Extra, tornerà tra circa un mese con una nuova intervista. Grazie mille e a presto!
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.